ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife Science.
It is time on Nightlife to, I thought, dip our toes into the remarkable world of science, because there is news constantly happening, and I'm weirdly excited about this. The first exoplanet, that is, planets outside of our solar system, that got discovered back in 1992. But the first orbiting around a sun-like star was announced about 30 years ago in 1995. And if you are a planet hunter, it revolutionised what you were doing. And now NASA's Exoplanet Archive has logged between 5,000 and 6,000 confirmed exoplanets, approaching 10,000 less confirmed. And some of them are strange, stranger than you might think. I thought a bit of fun would be to have a little look at some of the odd ones, including the strangest one yet discovered, along with other news from the scientific world. Associate Professor Charlie Lineweaver is with us. Charlie, thank you for being on Nightlife. Good. How are you? Happy Christmas? Everything in between?
Well, more importantly, happy solstice. The longest day of the year. You have
happy
never
solstice.
You know, the solstice, the summer solstice is when the axis of the Earth is pointing, the north axis is pointing away from the sun. So we in the southern hemisphere have the longest days. And that axis pointing exactly away from the sun happened at 2 a.m. this morning. And I am informed that the longest day was yesterday, but today is also very close.
This is fun to remember this sort of stuff, because I often get a bit argy about why we do, in Australia, seasons by calendar month and not by solstice. And I understand we're one of the few countries that does it that way.
Well, I'm not sure we don't do it. I mean, Christmas, for example, I think was basically a revamping of a pagan solstice, winter solstice rather than summer solstice.
We might have to bust some of these myths at some point. This will be fun. So, well, look,
it all comes back down to astronomy, Nick.
It
always
does. It does. And Charlie, I want to get to these distant planets in a moment or two, but as we're talking about Christmas, is it true that astronomers are actually excited about a star sparkling like a Christmas tree? Is this real?
It is real, but it's a little bit of a sensationalization, because here's the weird thing. There's a star called Fomalhaut, and that name means mouth of the whale. It's an Arabic name, and it's one of the brightest stars you can see. It'll be setting in the west about 11 p.m. tonight. It's one of the brightest stars, like I said. But here's an interesting thing. It's a young star. It's only about half a billion years old. And why that's interesting is, in the first half a billion years of our planet's existence, we think that it was an enormous collision feast. Bang, bang, bang. Matter of fact, if you look at the moon, you can see what some of those collisions were like. Now, the Earth got hit with about 20 times more collisions than the moon did, but the Earth just wiped them out with our wonderful hydrological cycle, rain and tectonics. Anyway, the wonderful thing about this is we've never seen this before, is when we look at the star Fomalhaut, we see it sparkle. Now, I use that term advisedly, but what we're really seeing is there's a disk of giant objects, 1 kilometer, 10 kilometer, 100 kilometer, 60 kilometer. Anyway, there are many, many size objects which are in a disk, which are colliding against each other, hitting each other, and making gigantic explosions, but even bigger than the one that wiped out the dinosaur. That was only a 6 kilometer object hitting the Earth, and it made it, you know, it revolutionized the life forms on the surface of the Earth. But we're talking things that are 10 times bigger, maybe 100 times, maybe even 1,000 times bigger, smashing into each other at a rate of something like 2,000 per day. In other words, but most of those we can't see. Oh, we can only see the biggest ones. And what's great about this is the biggest ones we've seen in the last 5 years, we've seen two that we have been able to detect at a distance of 25 light years. So that's the sense in which the star is sparkling, because we thought we had seen a planet, and then the planet disappeared. And now they see another planet, and it's a new type of object. It's called a circumstellar 1 and circumstellar 2. And what it is, like I said, collisions of very, very large objects that make such a big collision that you can see it. It's like a giant fireworks, and then it disappears. And so if you see planets that disappear, That's probably a giant collision. So what we're seeing in real time is the formation of a planetary system in the first half a billion years of that star's life, and that presumably was much what our solar system looked like in its first half a billion years. And so this is a wonderful confirmation of what we think we knew about the origin of our solar system. This is important because 4 billion years ago, that's in the first half a billion years of our planet's existence, that's approximately when life got started. So these are timescales that we're very interested in.
Charlie, I get why people are so excited about this now. That is actually amazing. I want to kind of stay on a vaguely Christmas theme. Letters to Santa. What do physicists want from Santa? What do astrophysicists want from Santa? Knowing, of course, that Santa's not looking at the bank balance and being too worried about anything.
Well, first of all, most of the time physicists are very down to earth. And they say, okay, what can we do with the equipment we have? What can I put in an application for? How much money can I get? Those are all kinds of concerns. But every once in a while, you take off your worry hat and say, if I had an unlimited budget, what would I want? And there's I think it was the New Scientist who went around asking scientists about this. And one of the things that I could really identify was they wanted to put telescopes in space, lots of them, and big ones. Now, here's the weird thing about – I don't know if you know this, but the bigger the wavelength, the longer the wavelength of the light you're looking at, the bigger the telescope has to be. That's why radio telescopes are much bigger than optical telescopes, and X-ray telescopes are even smaller. So if the wavelengths of gamma rays are the shortest and radio waves are the longest, so radio telescopes have the longest baseline. Now, why that's important is because if you have a giant telescope, that gives you much, much better angular resolution. I don't know if you've seen people with small telescopes. They can just barely make out, you know, some planets like Saturn.
But that man with a small telescope.
All right, so, but yeah, if your telescope were 1,000 times bigger, you could see in one field of view probably the red spot on Jupiter. If it were 1,000 times bigger than that, you could see a tiny, tiny fraction of the details in the red spot of Jupiter. So the bigger the telescope, the better the angular resolution, the more precise your vision, and that's what astronomers want. And so that's why they want telescopes in space, because when you put one telescope in one part of the solar system, another in another, then you can use it as if it were one big telescope that big. And that gives you incredible angular resolution. And that's, for example, when they put together a bunch of radio telescopes all over the Earth to make the biggest equivalent radio telescope, they were able to see the black hole at the center of our galaxy and at the center of another galaxy, a giant galaxy called M87. And so that's we want the biggest telescopes and separated by the biggest amount. Not only that, I've been talking now only about electromagnetic radiation. Yeah. But in the last 10 years or so, we have found a new type of astronomy called gravitational wave astronomy. But just like optical astronomy got larger to infrared and ultraviolet, and then we went to radio and microwave, and then radio, and we can go to ultraviolet, and then we can go to X-rays, then we can go to gamma rays. So the gigantic spectrum, our optical, what we're seeing with our eyes is a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the electromagnetic spectrum. Similarly, the gravitational waves that we've detected to date are a tiny, tiny fraction of the entire spectrum of gravitational waves. So we are only at the beginning of trying to expand out our knowledge of the frequency of gravitational waves, and that's what you can do when you go to outer space. You're making a gigantic, gigantic telescope. Matter of fact, there's one called LISA that's programmed to go up in 2035, so 10 years from now. It takes a lot of work to build these instruments because these are the most powerful, most sophisticated instruments, and there's a lot of technology that goes into it. But one is planned to go up. ESA is building it, the European Space Agency, and I'm looking so forward to seeing it because it will look essentially at the radio equivalent of gravitational waves. So much, much bigger, longer wavelengths. In other words, they could see gigantic galaxies colliding, not just black holes that are 10 or 20 or 30 solar masses, but 10 or 20 or 30 million and even billion solar masses when they're colliding. And they're colliding all over the universe, and you can see it all the way back to the Big Bang with these wonderful telescopes. So that's why I'm so excited about these gravitational waves.
Oh, you should be very excited about it. And just trying to imagine the engineering that goes into something like this, I can't even comprehend it, to be honest.
Oh, if you were a billionaire, you could comprehend it. It only takes a couple of billion. I mean, if you have $100 billion. billion. If you have $100 billion, you know what's one? What's 1%? Throw it at. You can make one of these beautiful telescopes. You can name it after yourself. You know, the Elon Musk telescope, gravitational wave telescope, or something. But another thing. Here's another thing I'm really excited about is one of these particle physicists said what I would like to do is have a muon collider. Now that probably doesn't tell you much, but let me explain. You know, electrons and muons and tauons, these are particles that are fundamental. Protons, by the way, are not fundamental. Uh-huh. Protons are made up of up, up, down, and neutrons are down, down, up. These are quarks. So when you collide, like the LHC in Switzerland, when you collide protons, it's like colliding garbage bags. And you get garbage and ketchup and bread and eggs all over the place. It's so messy. But if you have what's called a fundamental particle and you smash it together, then you get something like, we don't know what you're going to get, but you're going to get really, really high energy collision of something that's not like a garbage bag, but something that, as far as we know, is a point particle. And we're looking for, maybe it's not a point particle. Maybe it's not a fundamental particle. Maybe it's made out of pieces that we've never even conceived of. And that's what the beauty of a muon collider would do. The down part is that these things only last for about a microsecond. However, get this. If you're traveling at 99.99 the speed of light, that microsecond, they live for about a couple of seconds. Because of time dilation.
Yeah.
Oh, you're on top of this, Nick. Very good.
I just read a bunch of science fiction and don't actually know about it. But yeah.
Very good.
We are going to run out of time very, very soon. So talk to me about where we are with exoplanets, Charlie.
All right. So as you mentioned in the beginning, that the first exoplanets were in 1992. These were around pulsars. So people said, we're not interested in planets around pulsars. But then in 1995, 3 years later, they found the first planet around another star that was a main sequence star. This is like normal stars burning hydrogen. And so in the past, how long has it been now? It's been 30 years. We've gotten up to about 6,000 confirmed. I should point out that there are about 300, 400 billion stars in our galaxy. And the statistics are such, and I'm a big guy for statistics, the statistics are such that tell us that every one of those stars has some type of planetary system around it. Maybe they have 5, maybe they have 10, maybe they have 15. And so if you multiply 400 billion times 10, you get 4 trillion. So a reasonable estimate of the number of planets in our galaxy is 4 trillion.
Right.
And now, when we say we have detected 5,000, recently gone to 6,000 confirmed planets, it's only because this is where we can look. For example, one of the techniques to find planets is to, when the star and the planet, the orbit of the planet, the plane of the orbit of the planet is exactly in front of the star, then it dims the star, right? But most of the time, there's no alignment between the orbit of the planet and our view of the star. And so it doesn't block out the planet, and so we can't see it with that technique. Another technique, I mean, you have a planet that's also going around, let's say, in an orbit that's 10 years or 20 years or 30 years. You see it pass once. You say, well, was that a planet? I think it was. And then you have to wait 20 years for the next time it goes through. So the statistics you have to take care of you have to correct for these statistics. And when you do that, that's why the basis of my statement that all stars have some type of planetary system. Now, we say, 6,000 confirmed. I would prefer to say 10,000. And the reason I would say 10,000 is because there are very good lists of objects of interest that are something like 90 to 95%. We're sure, 90 to 95% sure that they are real planets and they will be confirmed. We know that because in the past, when we looked at the ones on this list and confirmed them, 90% were confirmed and only about 10% were saying, it was something else. So when I say 10,000, that means that's the more complete list, but slightly less confirmed. So if you want to be a stickler about it, there are 10,000 slightly less confirmed planets. And really, there are, a trillion? No, how many?
Yeah.
Four trillion, I guess. If there are 10 planets per star and 400 billion planets, then you have, you have 4 trillion. So 4 trillion planets in the galaxy. Now, that's just in the galaxy. We also think there are about a trillion galaxies in the universe. So, a lot of planets. There are planets everywhere. And so we're trying to find them and categorize them and find the habitable ones.
So tell me the weirdest one we've found before I have to say goodbye to you. I'm so excited for this.
All right. So a recent one was found with the James Webb Space Telescope. That's one of our best infrared telescopes. And they looked at a pulsar and they saw a planet that has a 7.8-hour year. That means it goes completely around the pulsar in 7.8 hours. And when you get that close to a star or a pulsar, then you really get tidally elongated. You know how there are tides, right? You've heard of the tides on the Earth, and they're about a meter or two, right? And so there's a bulge on the moon side of the Earth and a bulge on the anti-moon side of the Earth, and that's what's called a tide. And that's why there are two high tides per day. And so now, if we were really, really close to the moon, as it used to be, by the way, about 4 billion years ago, the moon was very, very close. It was like 10 times closer. And then the heights of the tide were about 1,000 times higher. Now, if you get even more, and if you replace the moon with a solar mass object, then you can just elongate the hell out of the planet. And that's what we're seeing in this pulsar planet. There's a planet that's really, really close to its host star, which is a pulsar. Very, very strong gravitational field. Very, very strong tidal elongation. So it's kind of like a lemon. It's not like a sphere anymore. It's more elongated like a lemon. So this is a lemon-shaped one. It's like 600 degrees, and it's got a carbon atmosphere. We've never seen an atmosphere on a Jupiter-sized planet that was made out of carbon. Usually they're hydrogen, helium, nitrogen, oxygen. But here we have one that is made out of carbon. And to make an atmosphere out of carbon, you have to get rid of all the oxygen. You have to get rid of all the hydrogen. Otherwise, you'd get CO2 and H2O. But anyway, so this is a really weird, it's a nice red, they call it the evil red, dim red lemon or something. And it's going around every 8 hours or so around this pulsar. And presumably, this is not the only one. We'll find more and more of these as time goes on. You may ask, how did a planet get around a pulsar? And the answer to that seems to be the pulsar forms when there's a supernova. Debris goes everywhere, and some of that debris falls back into a disk, and that disk kind of coagulates into a planet, much like we had think the moon formed around the Earth. So there you go.
Charlie, when life gives you a lemon planet, you got to make carbonated lemonade as an astrophysicist, and I love it.
Carbonated lemonade. That's CO2. You didn't have any O. You can't make carbonate. No O, there's no carbonate.
Thank you so much. You've been so much fun on Nightlife, and I really appreciate it.
All right, don't forget this muon colliders. That's a really Google that, muon collider. Fundamental particles that are going to smash.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.